and hope that you will join us right here, same time tomorrow.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
UN expresses concern about the situation of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar following a Monday coup there. Iran's foreign minister says the European Union can coordinate the U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Data from the U.S. COVID vaccination process show African Americans and Hispanics have received a smaller proportion of the shots. Good to have you. The United Nations has expressed concerns about the situation of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims currently in Myanmar following a Monday coup there.
There are about 600,000 Rohingyas that remain in Rakhine State, including 120,000 people who are, you know, effectively confined to camps. They cannot move freely and have extremely limited access to basic health and educational services. So our fear is that the events may make the situation worse.
The UN official said the recent coup will also have negative impacts on repatriation of Rohingya refugees from Bangladesh to Myanmar. Rohingya Muslims are a minority group that mainly lives in Myanmar's Rakhine State. In August 2017, Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown against them. Some 700,000 members of the Rohingya community fled and took refuge in neighboring Bangladesh. The UN has called the crackdown a genocide. Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw, is under heavy security a day after the military seized power in a coup. Thousands of soldiers have been deployed across the city. Checkpoints have been set up too. Myanmar's army staged a coup on Monday and declared a one-year state of emergency. It detained the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and other members of the ruling party. On Tuesday, the ousted National League for Democracy Party demanded the immediate release of its members. It called for the acknowledgement of the results of last year's election that the party won by a landslide. Myanmar's army claimed vote fraud and staged the coup in response. international reactions are pouring in over the military coup in Myanmar and the detention of top officials, including de facto ruler Aung San Suu Kyi there. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the detention of Myanmar's political leaders and urged the military to, quote, respect the will of the people. The UN Security Council is scheduled to hold an emergency meeting on Tuesday. The UN Special Envoy for the country will brief the 15-member council on the situation in Myanmar. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson also slammed the coup and called for the release of Suu Kyi and other officials. The British Foreign Office summoned Myanmar's envoy in London to lodge official protest against the military action. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden called on Myanmar's military to relinquish power while ordering a review to consider reinstating sanctions on Myanmar.
I think it's a message to all countries in the region countries who, will be asked to respond or to consider what the appropriate response will be in reaction to the events that have happened over the past couple of days. We have had intensive consultations at multiple levels with allies and partners in the region and around the world. I would expect many of those would come through the State Department, so I'd certainly refer to them for more specifics.
A previous White House statement said Washington is opposed to any attempt to alter the outcome of recent elections in Myanmar or impede the country's democratic transition. The U.S. also called for the immediate release of detained officials, warning the military of response from Washington. The coup and detentions in Myanmar followed days of escalating tensions between the government and the military over the last parliamentary elections. On Monday, the junta announced a purge of the government and Aung San Suu Kyi removing 24 ministers and replacing them with own picks, including for defense, interior, and finance. Coup leaders have already declared a one-year state of emergency. Political commentator Myra Dagepa says while the military coup against the Aung San Suu Kyi government is not correct, protests could only create more chaos.
The army's reaction to the election result is not the correct one at all. They must have accept the result, and even if they cannot accept it, the election result is not correct or the way they wanted to see, but this is not the way you figure out and you work with people in terms of bringing about democratic change. With Burma, anything could happen, but the problem is that the military that is in control, the military is the ones that have the upper hand. So Aung San Suu Kyi will be encouraging people to protest against the coup, but what is going to lead to that is more of a bloodshed and all this stuff, which is something that we don't want to see. And so before we get there, we have to think about what are the other ways that we can prevent bloodshed, because we don't want to see 1988 again.
Iran's foreign minister has proposed a path for Tehran and Washington to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
No, clearly there can be a mechanism to either synchronize it or coordinate what can be done. As you know, JCPOA has a mechanism built in to the deal, that is the Joint Commission. And the Joint Commission has a coordinator. The coordinator has two hats. It used to be Federico Mogherini, now it is Joseph Borrell. He has two hats. One hat is he's the High Representative of the European Union for Foreign Defense Policy. The other hat is the coordinator of the Joint Commission. He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran. Clearly, actions that Iran...
In an interview with CNN, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Iran, unlike the U.S., has proved it fulfills its promises. He noted that if the U.S. proves its bona fides and stops economic war on his country, Tehran will go back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Washington withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. In return, Iran gradually scaled back its commitments under the agreement, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their end of the bargain. However, Tehran has time and again said that its nuclear move is reversible if all parties abide by their obligations under the international accord. Political scientist Heinz Gertner says the European Union should work with the U.S. administration to lift all sanctions on Iran.
So what we do have now is a window of opportunity, and this window should not be closed too soon. Everybody seems to agree on the substance. First, to go back to the JCPOA, of course, there have to be some timely issues open and technical issues, and then maybe, we don't know when and how, maybe an original level address other issues. The question now is only who is doing the first step, and all the parties should avoid trying to play in poker game. So it's a gesture of goodwill that all do some steps in this direction. There can be a step-by-step approach. Of course, Iran is saying the U.S. left the deal and has to do the first move. But also, Iran can demonstrate that they show goodwill and step-by-step go back to its full commitments in the JCPOA. So the European Union immediately should go to the Biden administration and request that the secondary sanctions are lifted, that these companies, European companies, can do business with Iran again.
Representatives from Afghanistan's Taliban have paid a visit to Tehran for talks in the slow-paced peace process between the militant group and the Afghan government. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The first official visit by leaders of Afghanistan's Taliban to Iran. Led by the group's top political leader, Abdul Ghani Baradar, the delegation arrived in Tehran last week upon the invitation of Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. They came to Tehran with the hope that Iran would speed up the slow-paced intra-Afghan talks that has faced stalemate in Qatar.
We ask Iran to facilitate the peace talks between us and the Afghan government. Based on the Doha Agreement, the incumbent government in Afghanistan needs to dissolve and a new government be formed that includes all ethnic and political sects. We believe that a regional country like Iran has a better right to act as a mediator.
The Taliban and the Afghan government have been negotiating in the Qatari capital to reach a peace deal, but to no avail. The peace process started after the U.S. agreed to withdraw 12,000 of its troops from Afghanistan in exchange for the Taliban halting their attacks on international forces under a deal signed between the two sides in early 2020. The Taliban says as long as the U.S. is fighting them, it is not fit to be a neutral mediator.
United States is not mediator, you know. We had a negotiation with the United States for 18 months and which reached an agreement. And based on the agreement, we have intra-Afghan negotiation. United States is not a mediator because they are the Afghans to decide their destiny and their fate independently without intervention of any country.
Tehran lays emphasis on the need to form an inclusive Afghan government that encompasses all the influential political forces. In his meeting with the Taliban delegates, Iran's foreign minister stressed that different Afghan sides need to sit at the negotiating table to resolve Afghanistan's woes. Iran had also had similar meetings with Afghan state officials, where its voices readiness to help promote intra-Afghan talks as the ultimate way to restoring peace and stability to the war-wrecked country. Taliban leaders echo Iran's proposition of an inclusive government, saying this holds the key to the end of the problems gripping Afghanistan. Tehran maintains that this would offer Afghan people the chance to have the final say in their country, a right that has long been seized in the wake of foreign intervention in Kabul's affairs. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Welcome back. Early data from the COVID vaccination process in the U.S. show African Americans and Hispanics have received a smaller proportion of shots. The data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention examined two priority groups for receiving COVID-19 inoculations. Those groups are healthcare workers and nursing home residents. Although African Americans make up 16% of healthcare workers, they just received over 5% of the jabs. Similarly, Hispanics, who make up 11% of healthcare workers, received over 5% of shots. This is while white Americans received 60% of shots and accounted for 60% of healthcare workers. African Americans and Latinos are also among the hardest hit by COVID-19 in the U.S. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., says minorities in the U.S. have faced a racial disparity, even in healthcare, for decades.
Well, I wouldn't say it's surprising. There has been a generational disparity from decade to decade when it comes to medical care for Black Americans and Latinos. We can go back as far as the founding of this country, where there were people who were injured from the Black community, whether it was from beatings and they were left to die on their own without medical treatment. Fast forward all the way into the 21st century, and we're still seeing these disparities when it comes to the treatment of not just people who are getting vaccinated, but from people who are exposed to COVID-19. And then you have the distrust coming from definitely the Black community when it comes to the medical industry, when it comes to vaccines. Although many from the medical community have been trying to encourage members of the Black community to get vaccinated, because of historic racism coming from the medical community, a lot of members coming from the Black community are very skeptical that this vaccination really works or is not deleterious to their health.
Moving on, Black Lives Matter demonstrators in Rochester, New York protest police misconduct after a video emerged showing officers handcuffing and pepper spraying a 9-year-old girl.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Protesters gathered outside the police department and called for children protection. The Rochester mayor announced that officers involved in the incident have been suspended amid renewed outrage over police misconduct. Mayor Lovely Warren described what happened in Rochester as horrible. She didn't say how many officers were suspended. A total of 9 officers were at the scene. In the video, the girl repeatedly and frantically screams for her father as officers try to restrain her. The girl's identity has not yet been released. The European Commission moves to reassure citizens over the EU's COVID-19 vaccination strategy following a litany of errors. Health experts fear the way authorities in the bloc have so far handled the vaccine rollout might discourage a lot of people from taking the jab. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes reports.
On the streets of the EU's de facto capital, Brussels, it is certainly not difficult to find people willing to talk about their frustrations surrounding the 27-nation bloc's coronavirus vaccination rollout strategy.
We get a lot of information, but it's so different every day that it's hard to get a good view of the situation.
A lot of businesses getting shut down and stuff. So I think the faster we get the vaccine, the faster we'll open things back up.
A tiny percentage of the EU's 446 million population has so far been vaccinated. The European Commission is accused of being too slow to sign contracts with pharmaceutical firms. The European Medicines Agency is criticised for not approving vaccines quickly enough. EU member states have failed to prepare to administer the jabs. The European Commission has just introduced controls to monitor where vaccines produced in the EU are being exported to.
This is in order to really protect the advance purchase agreements that we have already signed and which safeguard that we have the availability of the vaccines that are contained in this advance purchase agreement.
Following pressure from the Commission for allegedly breaching contracts, AstraZeneca says it will now deliver 40 million vaccine doses to the EU before the end of next month. But that's still half the number originally envisaged. The way all parties have been acting has damaged public confidence, health professionals warn.
The concern is this could result in a large cohort refusing to take the vaccine. That would obviously have wide-ranging consequences for the EU's fight against COVID-19.
We have asked citizens if they will take the jab whenever the opportunity eventually arises.
For now, no. I don't know how safe is it. I don't know how safe is a vaccine to do it.
Older people worry because, you know, it's going to trigger your immune system. So if you're already, like, really weak.
As long as our old people get the vaccine first, I think it's okay. We can wait.
During a European Parliament debate, there were heated exchanges over the vaccine supply issues.
We expect all pharmaceutical companies to honor this contractual agreement with the European Union without further delay. Anything else is unacceptable.
For now at least, the European Commission's goal to ensure 70% of the EU's population is vaccinated before the end of August appears to be on shaky ground. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, World Health Organization experts investigating COVID-19 origins have visited an animal health facility in China's central city of Wuhan. The team has already visited key hospitals, the regional disease control center, and a Wuhan seafood market. The first cluster of COVID infections is believed to have originated from the market in late 2019. The WHO is trying to piece together how the novel coronavirus might have jumped from animals to humans. It began its investigation last week. The organization says the probe may not find all the answers to the origins of the pandemic. The UN agency has blasted critics of its investigation. It said those claiming to know better how the pandemic broke out should come forward. Well, that's your world news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Politics and religion in Islamic Revolution. Dear listeners, today is the third day of the 10-day dawn celebrations, which marked the period in which Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and in the 20th century. This revolution emerged when the whole world had accepted that human beings should accept either the communist ideology of the East or the capitalist ideology of the West. In view of this, different thinkers and intellectuals discussed the Islamic Revolution from various points of view. The Islamic Revolution was a unique phenomenon for them, as it differed from all previous revolutions and didn't comply with their calculations. Of course, this lack of compliance was quite usual, as religion had been decoupled from politics for centuries, and this had been taken for granted that religion does not have anything to do with politics. The idea of separation of politics from religion in the Islamic world dates back to the era of Umayyad and Abbasid rulers who had dominated the Islamic lands for over two centuries as the successors of the Prophet of Islam. Many of the clerics preferred to keep aloof from politics and ruling system to preserve Islam from becoming polluted by the acts of oppressive and despotic rulers. As a matter of fact, they opted sitting on the fence and merely embark on teaching instead of struggling against the misrule of the kings and tyrants who had usurped the rule. There were even some clerics who believed that religious scholars or ulama should not be involved in politics and governance, as they besmirched the sacredness of religion and the ulama. For them, interfering in politics and the affairs of the ruling class was a taboo. This mentality was so dominant that people like Sheikh Muhammad Abdul, student of the companion of Sayyid Jamaluddin Asadabadi, said, "I take refuge with God from politics. The world of politics, every letter that is pronounced in politics, every thought that crosses my mind about politics, every land in which politics is mentioned, every person who speaks of politics or thinks of politics." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, strove in his entire life to correct this perverse mentality. He tried his utmost to awaken dormant minds, first among the clerics, and then the masses of people, to show them that genuine Islam, which never keeps silent against oppression and tyranny. Thank you. late Imam Khomeini wrote the book Kashf al-Asrar about 30 years before the Islamic Revolution, back in 1941-1942. In part of this book, the Imam points to verse 59 of Surah Nisa of the Holy Quran, saying, Almighty God has ordered the formation of the Islamic government till the Day of Judgment, and it is clear that He has not obliged nobody's obedience except of these three, God, the Apostle, and the Ulul Amr, those vested with authority, and as He obliged on the entire Ummah to obey the Ulul Amr, it should be examined who these Ulul Amr are. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, in his book makes it clear that it is the duty of religious scholars and jurisprudents to supervise rulers. He writes, The only rule that the intellect considers as rightful and accepts it with open arms is the rule of God. We don't say that the rule must be for jurisprudence, but we say that the rule should be administered with God's laws, which is to the good of the country and the people. And this cannot be carried out without the supervision of religious scholars or ulama. Elsewhere in the book, Imam Khomeini writes, When we say the rule and authority at this time is with the jurisprudence, it means that this country's parliament should be formed by jurisprudence or under their supervision. In this book, Imam Khomeini has mentioned numerous narrations to prove the principle of Wilayat al-Faqih, or the principle of the rule of the supreme jurisprudent. No doubt, Imam Khomeini was the greatest reviver of Islam after the infallible Imams, peace be upon them. Of course, the Imam believed in the pure Islam which has been revealed to the Holy Prophet and preached by him and his infallible successors, and not the Islam of the Pahlavi regime, who pretended to be Muslims like the Umayyad and Abbasid rulers. In view of this, Imam Khomeini called the pure Islam as the Muhammadan Islam against the American Islam. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who took the helm of the Islamic Revolution after Imam Khomeini, explains the American Islam as follows. The American Islam is something with the name of Islam, which is at the service of the arrogant powers. The American Islam is the Islam of the people who have no pain and no suffering, who don't think of anything but themselves and their animalist welfare. They consider God and religion as the capital of traders, an instrument for amassing gold and seeking power. And they're either rashly cast into oblivion or shamelessly interpret all verses of the Holy Quran and narrations which are opposite to their inclination or profit. Yes, this is the American Islam, which urges the people to separate politics from political understanding. But the pure Muhammadan Islam considers politics as part of religion and inseparable from it, and invites all Muslims to political understanding and political action. And this is what Muslim nations should remember from their late Imam, the eloquent tongue of Islam. Interestingly, when Imam Khomeini started his movement, most people and even some clerics deemed it improper for religious scholars or ulama to interfere in politics. But Imam Khomeini put his trust in God and started his movement with firm determination. From the very beginning, he concentrated his attack on the ruling system of the Shah. First, he tried to advise the Shah, but little by little he changed his method and targeted the very existence of the regime. Imam Khomeini started his uprising in 1962, as the Pahlavi regime was trying to provide the ground for further infiltration and dominance of the United States and the Israeli regime in this country. Now the Iranian people are celebrating the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, whilst the Islamic Republic system of government has turned from strength to strength. The ever-increasing progress of the Iranian nation has astounded the world. Imam Khomeini said in his last testament, "There should be no doubt that the Islamic Revolution of Iran is separate from other revolutions. In its emergence, in the quality of its struggle, and in the motive of revolution and the uprising. And no doubt this is a divine gift and a present from the unseen world which God Almighty has granted to this oppressed and pillaged nation."
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome from the British capital. My name's Amina Taylor. Good to have you with us. And we begin in Russia, because Moscow has called on Washington to end its gross interference and fake news push in Russia's domestic affairs. This just days after the U.S. Secretary of State accused Russian police of using, quote, harsh tactics to arrest protesters who were demonstrating for the release of the jailed Western-backed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian police arrested hundreds of protesters across the country in cities such as Moscow and St. Petersburg for staging illegal demonstrations over the weekend. According to the Kremlin, mass gatherings in most parts of Russia have been banned under rules aimed at curbing the spread of COVID-19. Mohsen Abbas has been following this one, and it must be said, Mohsen, what do you make of these interference allegations? Is Russia correct here to have a go at the U.S. for its so-called meddling in Russian domestic affairs?
It's perfectly within its rights to have a go. The fact is that since the end of the Cold War, there's been nothing but endless regime change in the foreign policy of the Americans. And it's forced Moscow to interpret these interventions in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, you know, the list is endless, Libya, and of course their support for the colored revolutions in the Arab Spring to boot. It all is evidence the United States has an insatiable drive for regime change. Now, it's also doing it right in Russia's own backyard, if you like. It's manifesting itself also with a reaction from Russia, which views all these U.S. missiles, defense technologies, the alliance politics that goes on, and the support for NGOs, even in this territory, as being a detrimental set of, if you like, covert operations to undermine the Russian establishment. So, you know, It's on record, of course. Steve Cole, in a 1992 Washington Post article, said very clearly in there that William Casey, the then director of the CIA, had launched subversive propaganda through Afghanistan into Uzbekistan, and they actually wanted to print Qurans to spread amongst the people in Uzbekistan in order that they would become the kind of Muslim, if you like, opposition to the Soviet Union at that time. But we know it goes on, and it's just something the Russians are obviously clearly fed up with, and they're going to deal with on their own, in their own backyard, in a very, very, very forthright manner.
Now we're seeing protests in other parts of the world, for example, over there in the occupied Palestinian territories. We're also seeing disruption in the very backyard of the United States. Has Biden got time to be worried about what's going on in Moscow?
Biden thinks of Russia as a threat, just like his predecessor. They may not say it in as open a set of terms as Trump did, but they see all of these rising economic powers in Eurasia as a threat, Iran, China, and Russia in particular. So I think that Washington's record showed in overthrowing over their governments is that it's dismal. It doesn't work. They need to move on. They need to stop trying to do this. Their recent cases in Venezuela, again, they tried it in Lebanon and Syria, of course, is still ongoing. They must stop this and actually recognize other sovereign nations' rights to develop as they wish and not treat the people of those nations as geopolitical guinea pigs. It's proving catastrophic. The deaths are all down to American foreign policy. And, the overwhelming results are, Biden's administration should note this, that it fails. I mean, the interventions constantly fail time and time again. And Washington needs to stop creating victims, and it can't afford to continue this murder and mayhem that results from the policies. Their foreign prescriptions in all sorts of different parts of the world are losing because of this absolutely atrocious regime change set of policies.
Always good to have your analysis, Mohsen. Thank you, as always. Now to some other news, because it's been a month since that 11th hour post-Brexit trade deal between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and trade between the two sides is facing significant disruption at border points. Well, the culprit, increasingly complex paperwork and unprepared businesses. This is Saeed Pourreza fills us in.
On the surface, traffic seems to be moving relatively freely at UK borders. But behind the scenes, there are disruptions. In some cases, the increased red tape has led to food either not leaving the places in the UK where it's produced or rotting at border posts for several days.
The French have said they're enforcing customs and single market rules more strictly as of today, February 1st. That could mean more disruptions in the flow of goods between the UK and the European Union.
The disruptions don't only impact UK exports. On the shop floor in Northern Ireland, empty shelves in some supermarkets. Trucks arriving at British ports with incorrect or absent documentation, delaying their passage across the Irish Sea.
I've never seen disruption on Irish Sea movements on the scale we're seeing now. We've talked to lots of other hauliers, and we're reporting 40% of trailers are coming back from GB empty.
Brexit also seems to have turned the promise of solidarity and cooperation in the fight against COVID-19 into mere platitudes. Just last week, the EU said it was introducing export controls on its vaccines entering Northern Ireland. It's since reversed that decision, but after condemnation and threats of similar action from the UK.
It's an incredibly hostile and aggressive act by the European Union bloc. For years we were told after the European Union referendum vote that there couldn't be a hard border on the island of Ireland. And in one fell swoop, they've put that hard border in place.
Another victim of post-Brexit reality, online shoppers. Despite claims by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson of tariff-free trade, customers in the UK have found themselves facing extra charges when buying online from EU sellers. In some cases, a 20% jump in purchase prices in the form of VAT.
All of that only the tip of the iceberg. The trappings of Brexit were never going to be straightforward. We haven't seen the predicted chaos yet, but as of today, things may start to look very different. Saeed Pourreza, London.
In some related but slightly different news, protesters angry with coronavirus restrictions have staged rallies in a number of European cities. In Brussels, police arrested hundreds of angry anti-lockdown protesters who demonstrated against strict nighttime curfews imposed to combat a surge in COVID-19 restrictions. Meanwhile, in Hungary, hospitality workers gathered to protest the country's lockdown restrictions, asking for increased government aid. The country has been in one form or another of lockdown for close to 3 months. And across the border in Austria, ignoring social distancing guidelines and without masks, far-right demonstrators took to the capital, Vienna, to protest against the country's curfew and restrictions. The UN's Middle East peace coordinator has confirmed that the United Nations is continuing to urge Israel to help occupied Palestinians have access to vaccinations, a requirement under international law. So far, the Israeli regime has completed more than 2.5 million vaccinations, while Palestinians continue to wait. Over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with the virus, and more than 1,800 have lost their lives. Meanwhile, police have used water cannon to disperse crowds of protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds as thousands gathered to demand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's resignation on corruption charges. He faces charges of fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three cases involving billionaire associates and media moguls.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
And Robert, in Lakesh, we've been hearing about what's going on there in the occupied territories. Fill us in, especially on this situation of COVID vaccination apartheid.
Well, for months now, we've been hearing the calls for Israel from human rights groups, the United Nations, based upon the fact that Israel is the occupying power and under the Fourth Geneva Convention is supposed to grant things like vaccines to Palestinians and take care of their health in the territories they occupy to give Palestinians vaccines. However, we have not seen that. But after all the criticism that has came out, the Israeli Minister of War, Benny Gantz, has declared that there had been 5,000 vaccines sent to the occupied territories. We don't know exactly where they are being used. Allegations are that they're being sent to frontline workers. However, that cannot be confirmed at this moment. And the mainstream press in the West, interestingly, has picked upon on this, reporting that some vaccines have been sent over to the Palestinians when 5,000 vaccines reportedly sent, there's no confirmation of this, it can't be independently verified, for 5 million people is just not does not suffice. And many people have been pulling up the fact that Israel is constantly denying this based upon the Oslo Accords. However, they never implemented all of the different agreements that they signed up to during the Oslo Accords number one and number two that was signed in 1995. And so their legal basis, which they claim to be working from, does not add up. And ultimately, this is a situation of apartheid, of complete apartheid, as confirmed by Israel's top human rights organization, B'Tselem.
Right. I guess the online reaction would reflect that in part, Rob.
Absolutely. The first one we have here is from a user called Ahmed Khalid, who says, only 5,000 vaccines, not actually going towards helping anyone. It's about a show so the mainstream media can say, look, they gave some vaccines. This is utterly disgusting, and the lying, demonic pseudo-journalists in the West will now lick Israel's feet and stop questioning them. Got another one here as well from Kerry N. Mendoza, who says, apartheid Israel is withholding the coronavirus vaccine from Palestinians while simultaneously bombing their hospitals and maintaining a siege on the West Bank and Gaza. That's genocidal.
Right. When we move now from one part of the globe back over to Russia, a story that we touched on just moments ago, but you have a slightly different way of looking at the Navalny situation there, Rob.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of calls online for calling out the racist and Islamophobic nature of some of these protests and protesters in Russia, and of course many people calling out the Western role in these protests as well. And so, of course, we see that the mainstream press is praising this as some sort of wonderful revolution, which everyone should support unquestioningly. And meanwhile, what we have going on is that the Biden administration, according to his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, are considering allowing for Georgia to be included inside of NATO. And that step, in of itself, would, of course, mean that NATO forces would be essentially at a state of war with Russia. On top of that as well, we're still waiting for the Biden administration to get back, not just in the New START agreement, but other agreements from the Soviet era, which essentially stop a nuclear arms race and nuclear threats against the two nations. And so the situation that we're seeing right now on the ground, as being endorsed by the West, should, many people are arguing, be something that is reported upon by Western media in a critical manner, and also should be it should not be the role of the United States and their embassies inside of foreign countries like Russia to be taking stances on issues without actually understanding them first, and that is being interpreted as a push for regime change.
That's never stopped outside forces before, actually understanding what you're dealing with here, but perhaps some of the users online might have a more deft reckoning of what's going on.
The first comment we pulled up here from Twitter is from a user called JP, who says, BBC meddling and pushing for what they would see as the Russian Spring. They know no shame. We have another one here as well from Alfred, who comments on this and says, no one has noticed how racist and Islamophobic these demonstrator movements are. And the mainstream media has such double standards. Terrible reporting on this issue.
We'll continue to watch very closely and critique as always. Thank you, Rob. So we move on to some other news now, because EU officials have held talks on a long-term strategy to fight future pandemics. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, EU Commissioner for Health Stella Kyriakides, and EU Commissioner for Internal Market Thierry Breton spoke with scientists and pharmaceutical company CEOs involved in vaccine production. The bloc is seeking guidance from industry experts on how best to combat any future outbreaks that could rival the current crisis. Since the start of the pandemic, Europe has recorded more than 30 million infections with more than 730,000 deaths. The political situation in Iraq remains problematic. This as the government in Baghdad announced a postponement of the planned parliamentary elections despite relentless public anger against state corruption. Now, amid the uncertainty, we secured an exclusive interview with the nation's highest-ranking Sunni religious authority, and he spoke to us about the many troubles plaguing Iraqi society today. Robert Carter was in Baghdad and filed his report.
Any hopes of a good start to 2021 for Iraq were quickly squashed during January, with renewed criticism on the government amid the return of Daesh terror attacks to Baghdad, new US troop deployment, and a postponement of June's parliamentary elections. Amid the difficulties, V secured an exclusive interview with Iraq's most senior Sunni religious authority, Grand Mufti Mehdi al-Sumaidai, who was eager to speak out.
The situation for Sunnis is precarious and miserable. Every household suffers from different problems.
The Mufti blasted the government for failing to protect the people or improve living conditions. However, when asked about fears of sectarian strife, the Mufti made it clear he blames the politicians and is working closely with his Shia Muslim counterparts.
With trust in Allah and cooperation with the Shia Marzaiya, we achieved a school of unity and brotherhood in Islam. The suffering between Sunnis and Shias is equal. Neither suffers more than the other. This is because politicians don't fear Allah.
Before ending our discussion, the Mufti issued a stark warning to current Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, who he condemned for snubbing Iraq scholars.
During Nouri al-Maliki's term, he always used to respond to us even if he was busy. He would answer the phone and sort it out straight away. But today, in al-Kadhimi's term, he doesn't answer the phone. He doesn't answer anymore. To be honest, I am keeping the Sunnis quiet and putting pressure on them not to go onto the streets. If they do, there will be a big problem. However, if the government continues to attack the citizens who are asking for their rights, I'm going to make a fatwa, asking the people to go out. I will make a big problem for the government.
Last year saw large numbers of Iraqis take to the streets to demand reforms. In some cases, people were killed. If Baghdad continues to alienate respected scholars such as this, they might have lost the only ones capable of stopping the protests from becoming a revolt. Robert Carter, Baghdad.
We move from the Middle East to the Americas. Ahmed Caballo, a little bit more insider news here on what happened during another failed Venezuelan coup.
Yes, Amina. So Jorge Rodriguez, who is the new president of the Venezuelan National Assembly, showed evidence on Sunday of Leopold Lopez and Juan Guaido's involvement in the failed Gideon operation, which was the failed coup attempt that happened in May last year, that looked more like a scene from the A-Team than it did than a serious attempt to overthrow the Venezuelan government. But what is interesting about this is there's been a witness testimony from Yaxi Alvarez, and she's saying that she met with FBI and DEA officials in Florida last year, and that also Colombia's President Iván Duque was involved, as well as Colombia's top intelligence agency. Now, what's interesting is that she was meant to be protected by Colombia and was being protected by Colombia until Russia in the UN Security Council started to apply pressure on Colombia's role, and then they gave her up, as well as the other collaborators and Colombian and Venezuelan dissidents that were involved in the coup attempt, which shows there really is no honour amongst thieves. Now, there's been a reaction online, as you can imagine. Ben Norton says, a key coup plotter in the May 20 botched invasion of Venezuela said she met with FBI and DEA officials. She admitted Colombia's intelligence services aided them and knew everything. And President Iván Duque and far-right politician Kingpin Álvaro Uribe helped. Now, Not Here Follows says, American liberals are never upset when we pan coups in other people's countries, which is why it's so fascinating to watch them lose their stuff over the Jan 6 riots. Americanism, the privilege of never having to live through an actual coup. And that tweet reminds me of Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia's comments, when he says, the reason why there's no real coups in the United States is because there's no U.S. embassy in the United States.
A nice little gotcha moment there. We'll move on to another story that, if we're going to have more years of this, my head's already hurting.
Yeah, so this is about AIPAC, Joe Biden, and what we're expected to expect over the next 4 years. So the NBC removes a story on Biden officials' ties to $500,000 in AIPAC donations. Now, they removed the article because they said it didn't meet their editorial standards and that they should have got opposition, i.e. supporters of AIPAC, to comment on the story. Now, it's absurd. They never do this when it comes to Iran, Venezuela, who they routinely and habitually condemn and smear. They never get Iranian or Venezuelan voices that support the governments there to comment. So why this with AIPAC? I think we all know the reason. Jimmy Dore explaining the hypocrisy behind this decision.
After a number of readers raised issues with this article, NBC News conducted a review and has determined that it fell short of our reporting standards. In order to warrant publication, it needed on-the-record quotes from critics rather than anonymous ones. Why is that? They produce almost every article I read from NBC News is sourced with anonymous sources, especially the ones against anti-war voices. They're all sourcing. And the article should have also included more views from those who believe that donations to AIPAC do not represent a conflict. They should also have had more views from people who think AIPAC is a charity organization that helps Palestinians.
Right. I think he laid that out pretty clearly there. It was editorial rigor that was the problem with that article, Ahmed.
Yeah, I mean, people online are not buying that. So Lee Fang says, NBC News retracts a story about a high-level Biden security nominee donation to AIPAC. No factual errors are given. Instead, an editor's note claiming it wasn't really a conflict of interest. And Blake Wood says, NBC's Ken Dillon used to send his pieces to the CIA prior to publishing. I guess NBC thinks he should have run this story by AIPAC first. Now, what's interesting...
Time for one more, Ahmed, if you wish.
Yes, so Islam is Mathematics says, NBC News has pulled an article about Joe Biden that paints him in a negative light in regards to his senior advisor once donating $500,000 to Israel and AIPAC. This story is true, but they've pulled it and apologized for reporting it. LOL, it's about to be 4 years of this. And if you wanted proof of just how powerful the Israel lobby in the United States really is, this story demonstrates it. We talk about Russian interference in US politics. What we don't talk about is the absolute fact. The thing that is completely proven time and time again is that Israel has disproportionate power over the electoral policies and what the mainstream media reports in the United States.
Well, I'd like to see a presidential candidate who's successful, who didn't go to the AIPAC conference in the moments before that election. I can't think of any. Perhaps a viewer might want to set me straight on that one. Ahmed Kabbalah, thank you. And that is where we leave it, they say.